The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. My name is Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Renee Denfeltsch, who joins us on the telephone in Los Angeles. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Vic. How are you doing?
Wonderful, Renee, and I'm excited about talking to you about your new novel, The Butterfly Girl. Having read your previous novel and interviewing you about it, I certainly knew where I was going with this one. Would you call this a sequel? What would you call this?
You know, I'm calling it a companion book because I wrote it, you know, being very mindful that I didn't want people to feel they had to read the previous one.
Mm.
So you can read The Child Finder or you can not read The Child Finder. It's not, you know, this book stands alone, but it also works as a bit of a sequel to the last one as well.
I've interviewed you for your first two novels, and while I knew just a little bit about your own personal story, I never really asked you about it other than your love for libraries. But for this book, I feel that I really need to talk to you about that because there's such a connection between the story and your own personal story.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The older you get, I think hopefully, you get more comfortable with yourself, and it took me actually many decades of my life before I was really ready to write or talk about certain parts of my own life and how they influence my fiction. And I have to tell you, now that I'm doing it, it's really a relief. So I don't mind. This is a very personal novel for me because it was very much inspired by different parts of my own history. So I'm absolutely comfortable talking about that.
Which would you rather talk about first, the fictional variant or your own story?
Either one, actually, whichever you want to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your own experiences and then see how that morphed into this novel.
Sure.
What was your early life like?
You know, I was a child of a very difficult background. You know, I think many of us are. You know, I don't really believe there's kind of a hierarchy of trauma. You know, sometimes in our culture, we kind of think some things are worse than others. And while that's kind of privately true, sometimes the betrayals or traumas we experience, you know, I think they're all relative to us. So, you know, with that kind of caveat in mind, I grew up with a great deal of abuse and trauma. The man I considered my father is actually a registered predatory sex offender. And I grew up in a home, as you can imagine, he was also a armed robber and a pimp. So, you know, we lived this just a very difficult life and as a child. And while things on the surface appeared to get much better in my home, in many ways they didn't. And so by the time I was a young teenager, I was actually homeless. And I lived out on the streets. And one thing I found is for most children who are homeless and live on the streets, it's because the streets actually feel safer than the home that they escaped from. And I think that was definitely true in my case. And so this was in the early 1980s, and I lived on the streets of Portland, Oregon. And, you know, as you mentioned, libraries, I spent most of my time in the public library. I would go and, you know, I'm sure I smelled a high heaven and sit at the wooden tables and build stacks of books around myself. And I escaped into, you know, the sanctuary of story and books. You know, I really truly believe that libraries and books saved my life. So I ended up, as you can tell, I got off the streets and ended up having what I feel has been just a really wonderful life. A very redemptive life. I eventually went into justice work and became a foster parent, took in children much like myself. And so kind of in a wonderful kind of full circle ended up being inspired by that time in my life to write The Butterfly Girl.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Renee Denfeld, and her novel, The Butterfly Girl, just came out. I saw a piece that you wrote recently for the site Crime Reads, where you talk about a serial killer who was preying on victims in your area during that same period that you were homeless. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure, absolutely. So as I mentioned, I was living on the streets as a homeless child in the early 1980s. And for those on the West Coast, this is a very familiar name, and perhaps for others as well. At the time, a very notorious killer called the Green River Killer was murdering girls and women up and down the West Coast, primarily in the Seattle, Washington area, but also down in Oregon. And the Green River Killer actually ended up copping to murdering over 50 girls and women. And at the time, you know, I have to say, you know, living on the streets, people, the response by law enforcement and the public seemed to be, frankly, very indifferent. The news would report that another dead prostitute had been found. And, you know, now from my experience, I was a child living on the streets, and I'll be honest, you know, you do what you need to do to survive. There's no way to make money on the streets besides some very terrible things you have to do, including selling yourself. And this man was raping and murdering children, basically, that he found on the streets, and the media was just calling us prostitutes. And in truth, it was trafficking victims and kids that were just trying to survive. And so during the time period I was homeless, one of my friends disappeared, another girl on the streets, and later her naked body turned up in the woods, and they believed it was due to him. And so, you know, I lived in the kind of terror I think a lot of homeless people do, particularly homeless children, not just from the Green River Killer, who was allowed, basically, I think, to continue this rampage of murder for many years. It took them many years before anybody, they finally put together a task force. And, of course, he turned out to just be a very ordinary-looking man who led an ordinary-looking life. And he was getting his victims the way a lot of people do, which is, you know, this trafficking that's kind of allowed to occur. And, you know, it was very formative for me because it, you know, I think it taught me a lot of lessons about violence in our culture and, you know, for all of our posturing about it, how much we frankly let it happen.
No doubt you've been following the case of this alleged serial killer. I think his name is Samuel Little, who is apparently connected to many, many murders. Might be the most prolific serial killer in American history, and he was killing women that nobody would miss. And he was arrested over 100 times, but managed to never be charged with murder until just in the last decade.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's actually a few lines from The Butterfly Girl, the novel, in which there's a character, another character who is an investigator, Naomi, who was in The Child Finder as well. And she's looking into some of these disappearances of these street girls. And she says, you know, that people want to believe that there's just a handful of these brilliant sociopaths who are out there kind of outwitting the police at every turn. What we really don't want to face is that our system allows this violence to occur. The Green River Killer, like most of these people, you know, he wasn't a brilliant sociopath. He was actually, you know, in hindsight, you look at what he was doing, he was operating in plain sight. And I think what we really struggle with is for all the funding and everything we put towards law enforcement and incarceration, there's really just not focus or effort that is really genuinely put towards solving these sort of crimes. You know, all a man really, or a woman for that matter, all somebody needs to do is focus on preying upon the homeless or people that are down and out And, you know, they can get away with it for a very long period of time.
Mm. My guest is Renee Denfeld. Her new novel is The Butterfly Girl, and it's told from two points of view. We have the point of view of Naomi, who you've mentioned, the child finder of your previous book, who returns for this story because she has a very important task that she needs to accomplish. And then our other view is from that of a 12-year-old girl named Celia, who is homeless. She's felt like she had to flee her family, and Celia feels a lot like your story in a way.
Yes, she's very much, you know, her character is very inspired by my own history. Celia leaves home after she reported abuse that is occurring from her stepdad. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say, like most of these cases, even when they're reported, her stepdad was acquitted. And it's something that's not often talked about, is what happens to the victim, a child victim, after their abuser is acquitted. And so Celia ends up being homeless. And so, yeah, her, you know, she also spends a lot of time in the library, as I did when I was a street kid. Celia in particular, actually, she has her own imaginative kind of focus, and she believes that butterflies are going to save her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is how I came up with the title of the book. I mean, she has her own way of kind of channeling hope and finding kind of the poetry in life, and she kind of frequently escapes into her imagination, into the world of butterflies.
She is the butterfly girl, and that is her way of maintaining her life. That's the thing that keeps her going. That's her escape, and you have this wonderful librarian who I'm guessing is based on a librarian or librarians that you knew back in the day.
Absolutely, yeah. I vividly remember, you know, in the downtown library I spent so much time in, there was a tall, elderly librarian. She looked kind of like your stereotypical librarian. She even had those glasses that dangle on the little necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obviously a wig. And because, you know, half the time it was on crooked. And she'd sit at the desk up there, and I remember she read books that later became some of my favorite comfort books, like The Shell Seekers by Rosamund Pilcher.
Mm-hmm.
And but this librarian took such, you know, she obviously was so caring about me. And I have to say, you know, being homeless, the library is one of the few places you can go that's safe and welcoming. You know, most restaurants and other places I would try to go into a department store even to use the restroom, and I would get kicked out on my fanny. So, you know, the library is plays a profoundly important role, I think, in our life and our culture. It's a place where it doesn't matter how poor you are, or how down and out, or what you've experienced, it welcomes you. And the world of books welcomes you. And you can, you know, people like myself, I became, you know, very much self-educated through going to the library. And that's what happens to Celia. The library is also her sanctuary.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. And I'll continue my interview with Renee Denfeld right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. My guest today is Renee Denfeld. And some of our listeners are probably wondering, how does a 12-year-old girl survive for even 5 minutes on Skid Row in Portland? How is this possible? Well, in your story, she has a couple of boys who are her protectors, and we learn a lot about their stories, too.
Yeah, and that's what ends up happening is, you know, I think this is pretty much true across the country in a lot of places. We're just really seeing a real kind of epidemic of homelessness, and there's a lot of different reasons. I know in a lot of cities, like in Portland, Oregon, you know, it's even worse now than it was when I was a kid, in part because the ways that I escaped the streets just don't exist anymore. Like Celia, I ran around in a pack of street kids. You know, a lot of times homeless children gathered together for protection. We slept in groups under overpasses. You know, we, sat together on curbs while we panhandled. We'd go digging through dumpsters, trying to find things to eat. You know, it's very much, you know, this a street urchin life. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now about homelessness. And children are a big, there's a lot of homeless children. And yet we kind of don't see them. You know, we're kind of aware they're there. But my experience on the streets was very much that people just kind of look right through you. The only time they really see you is when they want something bad from you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I also ran around in a pack of street kids like Celia, and I became very close to them. And actually, a good girlfriend of mine, Julie, she and I got off the streets about the same time. When you're on the streets as a child, the big thing is when you get old enough to get a work permit. And so when you turn 15, you can, or 16 in some states, you can get a job. And so that's what I did. I got a job. My first job was at McDonald's. And I'll never forget, I wore that rust purple uniform. And this is what's different now, is at that time in the early 1980s, I was able to get a cheap studio apartment, I think, for $125. And it was filled with cockroaches, mm-hmm. but it was my first home, and it was my first safe home. And what's different now is I don't think that the avenue of affordable housing kind of as a way, kind of a ladder out of homelessness just doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that in your story and apparently and in reality, children have no one looking out for them? It seems like if they're homeless and they're adults, they have more access to services, and yet the children are so much more vulnerable. Why is that?
Oh, you ask such good questions. I hope we're not depressing our listeners too much here.
It has a beautiful ending, folks. Don't tune out.
Yeah, you know, and it's really important for me, particularly because, you know, actually I'm a very joyful, optimistic person. And, you know, so I do want people to know this is not a really, I don't see it as a really grim, depressing story. It's actually about a story of survival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think how we all deserve beauty and in our lives. And we all deserve to survive and thrive, even if, you know, somebody like me, I've experienced a lot of trauma. But I don't consider myself a broken or a damaged person at all. The people that hurt me might have been broken, but I'm not.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I do want to emphasize, you know, it's like an uplifting and optimistic story.
I agree. So answer my depressing question.
Yes, I will. You know, there's a lot of reasons. There are programs and services and shelters out there for older youth. But when you get to younger kids who are on the streets, there are some programs. There's not really enough by any stretch of the imagination. There's in many places there's no programs for homeless youth, and there's a variety of reasons for it. One reason I think is just a matter of legal issues, because cities don't want to be legally responsible for children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, children, so it falls, you know, you can have an adult come in and out of your shelter, and if that adult leaves your shelter and gets raped or hurt, you're not going to be really kind of legally responsible for them. But I think children pose like a really different kind of challenge for social service providers. And also, honestly, speaking as somebody who's been a longtime foster parent, I don't think children really belong in shelters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, children in shelters tend to get victimized a lot by other people going into the shelter, by the pimps who are hanging outside the shelter. So, you know, I think, you know, honestly, what I would love to see is more support and recruitment of foster families who are willing to take in children and teenagers who've been homeless, because, you know, children really do deserve, you know, to be in a family.
Mm. I agree. It's the Book Nook. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Building a More Informed Community with Independent News and Storytelling. And today, our story is told by Renee Denfeldt. It's her novel, her fiction, and her story, in a way, her own life story, the Butterfly Girl, inspired by some things that Renee experienced. Okay, let's talk about Naomi without doing any spoilers. I read The Child Finder. I know how she met her husband. I know how they got together. I know about Mrs. Cottle. What can we talk about here as far as Naomi and why she shows up in Portland and why Celia doesn't really register with her for a while?
Oh, yeah. So Naomi is a young woman investigator with a very significant traumatic past of her own, and she's very dedicated to finding missing children, which, again, is one of those issues we kind of know about and don't quite register the extent of how many people. I mean, it's a big country. People go missing. And so, yes, Naomi shows up in Portland, Oregon, and she's looking for somebody significant in her own life. And she's so focused on this particular on finding this one particular person that she fails to see even really kind of, I don't think, she doesn't quite even see Celia herself. She doesn't quite register. And her and Celia's paths begin to cross. And the two of them are kind of brought together. In a sense, I kind of see them as reflections of each other. One is still lost, and the other one has theoretically been found. But the novel really explores kind of those questions. You know, can you be lost even in when you have been found? You know, I'm really interested in these kind of themes and issues of our culture and what it means to be found and the ability we have to find each other. So hopefully that's not giving too many spoilers, that Naomi's looking for someone and Celia is actually the person she finds, though that's not the one she's looking for.
That is exactly why I wanted you to go over that, because I could have easily stepped on a landmine there and given away something crucial. And can we talk at all about the bad person? We really can't talk about the bad person in this, can we?
Yeah, I think we can a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of goes to what you actually brought up earlier about these people that are called serial killers, or, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable with that term. They're just kind of killers.
Uh-huh.
Just because I think in our culture we have such a focus on crime and violence and almost kind of, I don't want to say it's entertainment. But, you know, I mean, those kind of characters can feel unreal, I think, a lot of times when people write about them. And for me, they feel very real because of my own experience. So, yeah, there's a person who has been basically kind of allowed to harm a lot of girls on the streets. And that he comes up in this book as well as perhaps a reason why so many street girls are going missing in Portland, Oregon. And unlike my other books, the novel, you know, it's interesting. Most of my novels kind of dig into the perpetrators of crime, which I'm quite interested in. And that, which I'm happy to talk about, that didn't happen quite as much in this story,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was interesting for
mm-hmm.
me.
I noticed that. In your first novel, The Enchanted, we're spending all this time with a person who is on death row and has done something really horrible and is locked in solitary confinement, who loves books, and we end up feeling very sympathetic with this person. I think we need to talk a little bit about your day job, Renee. You were sensitive about the term serial killer. I'm thinking your day job might have something to do with this.
Yeah, I think so. You know, so after I got off the streets, myself, I became a freelance writer, and I mentioned I'm also a longtime foster parent. And eventually, over 10 years ago, I went into public defense work. Actually, I became a licensed investigator, and eventually actually became the chief investigator at our public defender's office. And I've worked hundreds of cases with a real strong focus. I've done a lot of death penalty work. And so, you know, when you read about the cases of people being exonerated, for instance, off death row, it's actually investigators like myself who do that work. And we joke the attorneys take all the credit for what we do.
Right.
But I'm the one who actually goes out and finds those witnesses and gets that DNA evidence and digs into these cases. It's a wonderful job as a person and as a writer. And just as a humanitarian, because I get to find out the truth. And to me, that's the interesting kind of piece that's missing from so many of our conversations about violence is like, well, what really happened? Why did it happen? Why do people do terrible things? Why? So I've worked a lot of death penalty cases, a lot of trafficking cases, a lot of different kind of public defense work, and it's, you know, it actually ended up just being really healing for me as a victim myself. Because, you know, I don't think we can't really prevent what we don't understand. And so I've worked on both sides. I've worked with a lot of victims, but I've also worked a lot with a lot of perpetrators. And rather than being triggering, it's actually been very helpful for me. And I think that's my discomfort with serial killers, because we like to paint this very lurid Hannibal Lecter kind of picture. We want to think that they are these brilliant sociopaths who are kind of these spectacular monsters. But in truth, they're just usually deeply disordered, often very pathetic people who we let get away with terrible things. And there's so much we could do to prevent and stop people like that. And I hope I'm not making listeners uncomfortable, but I think that there's just so much we could do in the prevention arena that we're not. And you know, so when I'm writing about perpetrators, I usually get more into, you know, that aspect of it too, because I think it's just too easy to paint this kind of sensational picture that maybe really isn't very truthful.
Mm. And in that first novel, The Enchanted, you have a character who's a death penalty investigator. You usually have a little autobiographical character in there somewhere, don't you?
It makes research really easy. Actually, the times is I find it amusing, because I've lived such a an interesting, I guess, a different kind of life, that when I have to research characters, like in my first novel, The Enchanted, the character I had to research was actually a Catholic priest. Because I had never, you know, I grew up just this feral kind of very traumatized life. I had never really been in a church before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually the ordinary people that I feel like, oh my gosh, I better research this, because I don't want to sound dumb. And when I'm depicting this person who's, for instance, the challenge for me would, if you ever asked me to write a book set like on an Ivy League college, I would really... really have to work hard on researching that one.
We won't ask you to do that, Renee. My guest is Renee Denfeld, and I have had the pleasure of reading your novels in order, beginning with The Enchanted and then The Child Finder, and then this one, The Butterfly Girl, which is a direct outgrowth of The Child Finder. And I would suggest that readers who have the leisure would love the pleasure of reading them in order. You don't have to, but that's how I did it, and it's really worth it. And we have just enough time for me to ask you something. I heard about that you used to leave poems out for other homeless kids to find. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. So when I finally got off the streets and, you know, I got the job at McDonald's, and I rented this horrible little studio apartment filled with cockroaches, one of the first things I did was I went and bought a used typewriter at a thrift store. And I remember it was missing like the R key, so I had to go write in the letter R.
Uh-huh.
And I would type up poems. That's how I started writing. I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted the stories that had saved me to kind of come alive myself. And I wanted to capture the beauty and poetry of life that I felt exists no matter how terrible our circumstances. So I would type up these poems and staple them together, and I would leave them around bus stops for other street kids.
Huh.
And ended up years later coming back to me in this really fascinating, interesting way when the famous author Catherine Dunn met me. And at that time I was, you know, slinging beer in a punk rock bar. And I'll never forget, Catherine Dunn came in and lowered her glasses, and she's the author of Geek Love, for those who don't quite recall, and she had this wonderful, deep, husky voice, and she said, "You're Renee," and she had actually found and read these poems at these bus stops.
Was she homeless?
Catherine Dunn? No, she had a really difficult history herself.
Oh,
she grew up in like Appalachia with a mom who beat her with sticks, and she just had a very difficult history. So Catherine Dunn, famous author at Geek Love, ended up taking me under her wing and mentoring me. She became like the big sister I never had. And she mentored me as a writer, and it was actually those poems that had somehow found their way. She never, you know, drove a car. She always rode the bus, and so she apparently had picked them up when I was writing them and remembered them, which I just thought was such a beautiful way of words kind of bringing people together.
What a wonderful story. Renee, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I so love talking to you, and I'm just so honored, and you know, want to thank you and thank your listeners too for listening and kind of sharing story with us.
Mm. The book is The Butterfly Girl. Renee Dunfeld wrote it. You heard about it on The Book Nook. Don't go away. We have a special Best of the Book Nook bonus coming your way right after this. The Book Nook continues. We're going to close the program out today with a tribute to the late Harold Bloom. Professor Harold Bloom died recently. He was considered to be our foremost literary critic of the last half of the 20th century. He was 89 years old. I had the opportunity to talk to Harold twice on the program. The first time was back in the last century, back in the 1990s. We had him on for his book about William Shakespeare, and how William Shakespeare was a force who gives us meaning. And then I had him back one more time in 2001 to talk about his book Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Harold was a brilliant man. He could read a 400-page book in about an hour. He had a photographic memory. He had thousands of poems memorized, as he demonstrates in this interview. From the Best of the Book Nook, Professor Harold Bloom.
My guest is Harold Bloom. Well, Harold, you have suggested a remedy in a way to some of this dumbing down with this new collection.
Well, I have put together what I think is it's a good collection. I carefully, it's got 83 poems and 41 stories in it. I think that's the number. I'd have to look at the beginning of the introduction, which I'm not doing at the moment, but I think it's 41 stories, that's it, and 83 poems, including one long poem, Christina Rossetti's Goblin's Market. And I very carefully chose Nothing, which was written after the First World War, you know, after which the various waves of modernism came, because I wanted fantasy and visionary quality and, you know, sort of primal storytelling and high lyrical poetry. And I don't know, I have put together a very great collection. I've been going around reading from it. Would you indulge me while I read my favorite poem from the whole collection?
I would be delighted.
You know the marvelous poem by Lewis Carroll called A Pigtail?
I would love to hear that.
I will start it from memory, and then if I have trouble, I will pick up the book. There was a pig that sat alone beside a ruined pump. By day and night he made his moan. It would have stirred a heart of stone to see him wring his hoofs and groan because he could not jump. A certain camel heard him shout, a camel with a hump. Oh, is it grief or is it gout? What is this bellowing about? That pig replied with quivering snout, because I cannot jump. That camel scanned him dreamy-eyed, methinks you are too plump. I never knew a pig so wide that wobbled so from side to side, who could, however much he tried, do such a thing as jump. Yet mark those trees 2 miles away, all clustered in a clump. If you could trot there twice a day, not ever pause for rest or play, in the far future, who can say you may be fit to jump? That camel passed and left him there beside the ruined pump. Oh, horrid was that pig's despair. His shrieks of anguish filled the air. He wrung his hoofs, he rent his hair, because he could not jump. There was a frog that wandered by, a sleek and shining lump, inspected him with fishy eye and said, oh, pig, what makes you cry? And bitter was that pig's reply, because I cannot jump. That frog, he grinned a grin of glee and hit his chest a thump. Oh, pig, he said, be ruled by me, and you shall see what you shall see. This minute for a trifling fee, I'll teach you how to jump. You may be faint from many a fall and bruised by many a bump, but if you persevere through all and practice first on something small, concluding with a 10-foot wall, you'll find that you can jump. That pig looked up with joyful start. Oh, frog, you are a thump. Your words have healed my inward smart. Come name your fee and do your part. Bring comfort to a broken heart by teaching me to jump. My fee shall be a mutton chop. My goal is ruin pump. Observe with what an airy flop I plant myself upon the top. Now bend your knees and take a hop, for that's the way to jump. Up rose that pig and rushed full whack against the ruined pump, rolled over like an empty sack and settled down upon his back, while all his bones at once went crack. It was a fatal jump. That camel passed as day grew dim around the ruined pump. Oh, broken heart, oh, broken limb, it needs, that camel said to him, something more fairy-like and slim to execute a jump. That pig lay still as any stone and could not stir a stump, nor ever, if the truth were known, was he again observed to moan, nor ever wring his hoofs and groan because he could not jump. That frog made no remark, for he was dismal as a dump. He knew the consequence must be that he would never get his fee, and still he sits in misery upon that ruined pump. Isn't that a marvelous poem?
Wonderful. And Lewis Carroll.
It's an adorable poem. I've loved that since I was a little bear.
Clearly, Lewis is one of your favorites. He has a number in this collection.
There are more poems by Lewis Carroll than by anyone else except Anonymous.
Anonymous is right up there, and Edward Lear got a few as well.
Edward Lear is there, and there's a lot of Christina Rossetti. I am fascinated by Christina Rossetti, who was a marvelous poet. And who is especially fine, as I say, for extremely intelligent children of all ages. Do you know the Mad Gardener song by Lewis Carroll?
I remember it well.
Ah, then we will not. We will not recite that.
Go, please do.
Well, it's another of my favorites in the book. He thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. He looked again and found it was a letter from his wife. At length I realized, he said, the bitterness of life. He thought he saw a buffalo upon the chimney piece. He looked again and found it was his sister's husband's niece. Unless you leave this house, he said, I'll send for the police. He thought he saw a rattlesnake that questioned him in Greek. He looked again and found it was the middle of next week. The one thing I regret, he said, is that it cannot speak. He thought he saw a banker's clerk descending from the bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus. If this should stay to dine, he said, there won't be much for us. He thought he saw a kangaroo that worked a coffee mill. He looked again and found it was a vegetable pill. Were I to swallow this, he said, I should be very ill. He thought he saw a coach and four that stood beside his bed. He looked again and found it was a bear without a head. Poor thing, he said, poor silly thing, it's waiting to be fed. He thought he saw an albatross that fluttered around the lamp. He looked again and found it was a penny postage stamp. You'd best be getting home, he said, the nights are very damp. He thought he saw a garden door that opened with a key. He looked again and found it was a double roll of three, and all its mystery, he said, is clear as day to me. And in the final magnificent stanza, which I love best, he thought he saw an argument that proved he was the Pope. He looked again and found it was a bar of mottled soap, a fact so dread, he faintly said, extinguishes all hope.
Harold Bloom. With a poem by Lewis Carroll from his book, Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Lewis Carroll never lost that childlike sense, did he?
Well, he was a very complex person indeed. He really was in love with little Alice Liddell. And I believe that when she was going on 16... and he must at that point have been in his middle or late 40s, something like that anyway. He actually went to Mr. and Mrs. Liddell and seriously suggested himself for their daughter's hand. Mm. They showed him the door and forbade, I believe, all future communication between him and the young Liddell girls.
Mm-hmm.
So he was he was clearly, in his gentle way, an obsessed person.
And
it certainly stimulated a remarkable imagination. You know, there are wonderful books for children in the 20th century. I can think of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web, Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willow, James Thurber's wonderful The 13 Clocks, and many more. But I don't suppose that there are in the language anything quite as wonderful for children as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass.
As I read the collection, Harold, I was delighted to rediscover things that I'd read when I was young, and also so many things that I had never read before. You've divided the sections up into seasons. And so
I did that partly because it's so difficult. I mean, here is a book of almost 600 pages, and here indeed, as I said, are some 80-odd poems and 40-odd stories, and I didn't want to just do them chronologically. It didn't seem very imaginative. And many, many years ago, actually 44 years ago, with my friend, the poet John Hollander, I had edited an anthology of poems for young people called The Wind, and which was arranged by the seasons. So I decided I would run this through a kind of seasonal cycle also. It necessarily involved a certain kind of arbitrariness at times, but sometimes it sort of worked, I thought.
Well, sometimes it's obvious why you selected a certain piece for a certain season, and I thought it was humorous that a lot of your favorite Russian writers ended up in the wintertime.
Well, a lot of my favorite Russian writers, like Gogol and even Turgenev and
Pushkin.
Certainly Pushkin and the Queen of Spades are writing very beautiful but spooky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that certain things that I put in the collection, I'm really very proud of. I had known them for a long time, but they came to me at the right moment. There is a wonderful ghost story by Edith Wharton called All Souls, which I put into the winter section. And there is an equally scary and highly original story by the children's writer E. Nesbitt called In the Dark, which I put in also. And in the summer section, I've revived two wonderful Edwardian women writers who, for some reason, I don't see much about these days, Catherine Sinclair and Mary De Morgan, both of them, I think, with remarkable stories. And of course, I've led off the summer section with the longest story in the book, almost 30 pages long, John Ruskin's wonderful, I suppose it's really a novella rather than a story, The King of the Golden River, which is a marvelous piece of mythological imagination.
Harold Bloom joins us. His new collection, Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages, and his book, How to Read and Why, has just come out in a paperback, and as Harold mentioned, they are companions in a way.
In a way, the direction is a little bit different. I remember saying towards the end of the introduction to the Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages that if you're going to go to Shakespeare and Chekhov, if you're going to reach Henry James and Jane Austen, then you're best prepared. Obviously, I didn't put that in there, not if you're reading J.K. Rowling and Tolkien, but if you've read Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear, Robert Louis Stevenson and Rudyard Kipling, who are very well represented in the volume. But, you know, there's a moment in the introduction which I would like to read aloud, if you'll bear with me for a second.
Certainly.
It's at the end of the introduction where I say, reading well makes children more interesting both to themselves and others, a process in which they will develop a sense of being separate and distinct selves. To be alone with a true book is to be able to see more about who you are. To reread Carroll's Alice books is to be reminded of how strong Alice herself is and can be a path to sharing her independence. And then I quote, "Hold your tongue," said the queen, turning purple. "I won't," said Alice. "Off with her head," the queen shouted at the top of her voice. Nobody moved. "Who cares for you?" said Alice. She had grown to her full size by this time. "You're nothing but a pack of cards." And I comment, the 7-year-old Alice is supremely courageous, and like Hamlet is only mad north-northwest. Hamlet, perhaps the most fascinating person in all literature, is a very dangerous role model, but Alice is both outrageous and prudential and well worth imitating. More than once in her or his life, every reader will grow to full size by crying out to the right auditors, "Who cares for you? You are nothing but a pack of cards."
I love that.
Well, I once resigned from a English department by quoting that and then leaving the room.
Mm. That must have been a wonderfully delicious moment for you.
Well, it was. It was a very emotional moment. I have been a professor of absolutely nothing now, a non-department of one at Yale for the last 26 years.
Yes, as they like to refer to you in the New York Times book section on Sundays, the Sterling Professor.
Yes, that was, however, I think that was Chip McGrath getting back at me. I mean, he saw to it that a post-colonialist, I don't mind putting this quarrel out in the public, this is a fellow who had once been my graduate student at Yale and then departed graduate school and then reviewed my Weston Cannon book back in the days when he was working for the New Yorker by opening his review by saying, "Every time I take the train from Boston to New York and it stops in New Haven, I put the newspaper up about my head for fear that Professor Bloom will walk in and see me and say, 'McGrath, where is that essay on Wallace Stevens you owe me?'" Which was a pretty good joke. But then he didn't exactly win my heart by assigning my How to Read and Why to, of all people, a post-colonialist. You know who those people are?
Mm-hmm.
Post-colonialist denounced it and said, "Well, it's not a good book at all. I mean, how could it be a good book? It's not greatly interested in post-colonialism."
Hmm.
"It isn't even interested in..." Never mind. There are all sorts of things it is not interested in. The stuff that keeps the academy going these days.
So the New York Times continues to be a bramble.
The New York Times Book Review and I are in, I guess, a sort of permanent state of war until such time as Chip McGrath stops being the editor of it.
That was Professor Harold Bloom, who died recently at the age of 89. My second interview with him, recorded back in 2001 for his book Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Harold was always feuding with someone. He feuded with the New York Times, as he indicated there at the end of the interview. And his obituary ran on the front page of the New York Times recently. He was our leading literary critic of the last half of the 20th century, a brilliant man, yet he never made me feel like I wasn't as smart as he was. He was not condescending. He was very gentle. He was very kind. He was a wonderful person to interview. He had a photographic memory. He could recite all that poetry from memory. And Harold, I know you had a difficult life, and I hope you rest in peace. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.